Over the past several months, we've been journeying through the Gospel of John in a series of messages entitled, Believing is Seeing. Now, those of you that were here when we began the series know that we began it with a different title. We called it Seeing is Believing. But partway through, I came to the conclusion that it really is better if you reverse the word order. And so we changed the title. I don't think that happens very often with preachers. They usually don't change a series title in the middle, but we did. And I think that nowhere do you see that more evident than in our text today. John chapter 20 records the most significant event in human history. Now, I realize that that sounds rather strong language. The most significant event in human history? Yes, it is. When Jesus Christ arose from the dead, it changed everything. And that is what John records here. Now, all four Gospels record this incident in detail. They all give us some different details to give us the full picture. But John, I think, here places special emphasis on what people saw and sometimes on what they didn't see. And that's the emphasis I would like to make this morning. I think from the experiences of the people mentioned in this chapter, we can learn some very important lessons about spiritual vision. Now, the first person that John introduces in this chapter is Mary Magdalene. In verse 1, we read, early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. Now, you remember that Jesus had been crucified on Friday. We call that Good Friday. That was the Jewish Passover. Now, that was a special day in itself, a day of celebration. But the following day, Saturday, was the Sabbath day. You could do no work. And John mentioned that the Jewish leaders went to Pontius Pilate toward the afternoon of Good Friday and said, "We don't want the bodies of these criminals hanging on the cross over the Sabbath. Could you please expedite the process so we could get them off the cross?" Jesus, by that point, had already died. Two of the members of the Sanhedrin, Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea, came and took the body of Jesus. Joseph had a new tomb that had never been used. And they very quickly wrapped up Jesus' body and put him in the tomb, because when the sun went down on Friday, the Sabbath began and you could do no work. And it's probably with that in mind that Mary comes to the tomb. One of the other Gospels tell us that Mary came with a couple of other women and they brought spices that they would use to wrap the body in. They didn't embalm back then. They would just put spices on the outside. And she came, it says, while it was still dark, before dawn, as early as she could. Now remember, this is Sunday morning. And when she gets there, she finds that the stone that had been rolled in front of the tomb had been rolled away from the entrance. Now, Mary saw that the stone had been removed, but what she didn't see was the body inside. She looked in and realized that the body of Jesus was not there. So according to verse 2, she came running to Simon Peter and the other disciple whom Jesus loved. That was kind of John's favorite way of referring to himself. So Mary comes to Peter and John and says, "They've taken the Lord out of the tomb and we don't know where they've put him." Now, Peter and John take off for the tomb themselves. I'm going to pick that part of the story up later in the message. But if you jump down to verses 10 through 14, we read again about Mary. The disciples, meaning Peter and John, went back to their homes, but Mary stood outside the tomb crying. As she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb and saw two angels in white seated where Jesus' body had been, one at the head, the other at the foot. They asked her, "Woman, why are you crying?" "They have taken my Lord away," she said, "and I don't know where they put him." At this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, but she did not realize that it was Jesus. Here we have Mary. After Peter and John had come, they looked inside. It's true, Jesus' body isn't there. They left. Mary stayed. And she's there weeping. She's crying. She looks back into the tomb. She's already seen what's in, what's not in there. She's had that confirmed through Peter and John coming, and yes, she's right. There's nobody there, but she looks back in again and she sees two angels and they ask her, "Why are you crying?" And she said, "Someone's taken the Lord and we don't know where they put him." Does it seem surprising to you that Mary didn't recognize who they were? Or if she did, it didn't seem all that significant? I mean, most of the time in the Bible, when somebody was confronted by an angel, they were scared to death. I mean, they were shaken. Mary just carries on a conversation like it's nobody. And I don't know if she didn't realize that they truly were angels or if she really didn't care. She just answered the question. The Lord's body is gone. Someone's taken him. We don't know where they've taken him. See, she wasn't able to pick up on the clues provided by the empty grave clothes or even by the angels who spoke to her. And then we're told that Jesus himself comes up behind her. And notice what happens. She turns and she sees him, but she doesn't really see him. She sees somebody there, but she doesn't recognize him. So the very object of her concern is right in front of her, but she doesn't see that that's who it is. Such can be the blinding effect of profound emotions. She sees, but she doesn't see. And I've entitled this blurred vision. This is what happens when we see with the heart. When we allow our emotions to override and affect how we view things. See, in her case, her emotions had obscured her ability to see the truth. She was so caught up in how she felt that she couldn't understand the truth that was right in front of her. Now, I'm not saying this as some kind of an indictment. I'm not criticizing Mary. I mean, place yourself in the sandals of these folks for just a moment. Imagine losing a very close friend or a family member. And you were there at the funeral. You saw the body. Maybe you saw them close the casket. You went to the cemetery. You watched as, you know, the hole was there. And maybe you went back afterward and the casket had been laid in the ground. You come back a few days later, maybe to put flowers there or to just spend some time there. And when you get there, the hole has been reopened, the casket is open, and there's no body. What would you think? Somebody stole the body. And in all of the grief and in all of the emotion of the moment, that would be very upsetting. So I'm not trying to criticize or to cast doubt upon Mary. All I'm saying is this points to a very common problem with our spiritual eyesight. If our emotions get all stirred up, sometimes it's hard to see the truth. Our vision can be blurry. Now, before anyone accuses me of being sexist, I'm not using Mary as some kind of stereotype saying, you know, women are always too emotional. Not at all. In fact, if you go to the end of Luke's gospel, in Luke chapter 24, you read of two followers of Jesus, and according to the text, they were both men, who were walking from the city of Jerusalem to the town of Emmaus. And in Luke 24:17, he describes them as being downcast. A very emotional word. They were depressed. They were despondent. They were just as emotional, though maybe they didn't express it exactly the same way, but they were just as emotional as Mary was. And the same thing was true. Jesus appeared and walked along with them, and they didn't recognize him. Even when he told them the truth about how Jesus would have to suffer and die, according to the scriptures, we're told that he started from that point and beginning with the law and the prophets, explained to them how this had to happen. They still didn't get it. Why? Because they were so caught up in the feeling of the moment. So this can happen to men as well as women. Ladies, don't throw hymnal at me. We're not being stereotype here. It can happen to any of us. We can allow our emotions to cloud our vision of the truth. I like how William Barclay applies this text. We see there were two very simple yet very profound reasons why Mary did not recognize Jesus. One, she could not recognize him because of her tears. They blinded her eyes so that she could not see. When we lose a dear one, there's always sorrow in our hearts and tears shed or unshed in our eyes. That is natural and inevitable. At the same time, we must never allow our tears to blind us to the glory of heaven. Tears there must be, but through the tears we should glimpse the glory. And then too, she could not recognize Jesus because she insisted on facing the wrong direction. She could not take her eyes off the tomb, and so she had her back to him. Again, it is often so with us. At such a time, our eyes are upon the cold earth of the grave, but we must wrench our eyes away from that. When sorrow comes, we must never let tears blind our eyes to glory, and we must never fasten our eyes upon the grave that we forget about heaven. Now, John continues in verses 15 through 18. "Woman," he said, "why are you crying? Who is it that you're looking for?" Thinking he was the gardener, she said, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you've put him and I will get him." Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned toward him and cried out in Aramaic, "Rabboni," which means teacher. Jesus said, "Do not hold on to me, for I have not yet returned to the Father. Go instead to my brothers and tell them, I am returning to my Father and your Father, to my God and to your God." Mary Magdalene went to the disciples and with the news, "I have" what? "Seen the Lord." She didn't see him at first because her vision was blurry. But now she has seen the Lord, and she told him that he had said these things to her. You notice that the Lord never rebuked Mary. He didn't say, "Mary, what's wrong with you? It's me." He just said her name and allowed her to realize the truth. And she saw. She could report to the disciples, "I have seen the Lord." Now, the next character I want to consider from this text is the Apostle Thomas. John notes that his nickname in those days was Didymus, Greek word that meant twin. And scholars have got all kinds of suggestions why he might have been called twin. Maybe he was one of a twin. Maybe he bore a striking resemblance to somebody. Who knows? But that was his nickname. We tend to give him a different nickname, don't we? But it starts with the same letter D. Doubting Thomas, right? And he gets that nickname from this passage. Look at verses 24 and 25. Now Thomas, called Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where his nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe. Here Thomas is a living example of that old maxim, seeing is believing. If I see it, then I'll believe. And notice what he says, unless I see, I will not believe. Now, the Bible tells us that Thomas hailed from Galilee. I think if Thomas were around today, we would say he came from Missouri. The show me state. Show me and then I'll believe. That was his attitude. Belligerent in his pessimism, he said that he would never believe that Jesus had risen from the dead until he had seen it with his own eyes. No skepticism could be more thoroughgoing than this. And it's perhaps worth noting that nobody else in the New Testament makes demands like these before believing. You don't see somebody saying, until I see it, I'm not going to believe. So Thomas, probably rightly so, got his reputation as being somewhat of a skeptic. I'm calling this belligerent vision. This is seeing with the mind. This is the old Joe Friday from the old Dragnet show, remember that? Just the facts, ma'am. That's all he cared about. Didn't care about what somebody felt, didn't care about someone's opinion, just the facts. And many people take that approach as well. They want to see it. They want it proven to them. Now, doubt is often an intellectual problem. We want to believe, but the faith is overwhelmed by problems and questions. And many today look at so-called scientific evidence that presumably would speak against what the scriptures say. And they have doubts. They have trouble. They want to have all the problems solved. They want to have all the questions answered before they'll commit to believe. But what we see here in the example of Thomas, he reminds us that unbelief robs us of blessings and opportunities. It may sound sophisticated and intellectual to question the scriptures, to question what Jesus did, or even if he existed at all. But such questions are usually evidence of hard hearts, not searching minds. Thomas represents the scientific approach to life, and it didn't work. After all, when a skeptic says, I will not believe unless, he's already admitting that he doesn't believe. He believes in the validity of his test or experiment that he has devised, but he doesn't believe in what's being said. If he can have his faith in his own scientific approach, why can't he have faith in what God has revealed? That's what Thomas was saying. Thomas was saying, I will decide what's true. I will determine what's right and what's wrong. And that's a very common approach today. Many people will say, truth is subjective. That may be true for you, but it may not be true for me. Since when is that ever the measurement of truth? It just doesn't work, but that's how many people approach it. And that, like I said, this is that belligerent vision. I will not believe until it meets my criterion. Until I'm satisfied, I'm not going to believe. Now, Thomas's vision is corrected in verses 26 through 29. A week later, Jesus' disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. Then he said to Thomas, put your finger here, see my hands? Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe. Thomas said to him, my Lord and my God. Then Jesus told him, because you have seen me, you believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believed. Now Jesus knew what Thomas needed. and he provided the physical proof, but he also gave a reproof. Stop doubting and believe. Don't just use this filter of your mind and your intellect and say, I'm too smart for this. Stop doubting and believe. And then he adds in verse 29, because you have seen me, you believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and have yet believed. Now we know from history that Thomas did overcome this. In fact, he was one of the most committed of those early disciples. He took the gospel all the way to India. He was a very strong ambassador for the Lord. He overcame that. But Jesus adds that those who believe without seeing are blessed. And that brings us to the third type of spiritual eyesight, what I'm calling believing vision. Or this is seeing with the will. Now here we go back, if you'll go back in the text to beginning in verse 3. So Peter and the other disciple started for the tomb. Both were running, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. He bent over and looked at the strips of linen lying there, but did not go in. Then Simon Peter, who was behind him, arrived and went into the tomb. He saw the strips of linen lying there, as well as the burial cloth that had been around Jesus' head. The cloth was folded up by itself, separate from the linen. Finally, the other disciple, who had reached the tomb first, also went inside. He saw and believed. They still did not understand from Scripture that Jesus had to rise from the dead. I remember in my years at Bible college, I had a course on the Gospel of John. And when we got to this passage, the professor pointed out, he said, you think John was just a little bit competitive? Because if you notice in that text how many times he points out that he beat Peter to the tomb, 4 or 5 times he keeps putting it in there. You know, the other disciple got there first. And the disciple who got there first, he looked in. But Peter, who arrived later, he went in. And then the other disciple who got there first, I mean, he keeps putting it over and over. I don't know if that was the case or not. But what you see is these two men coming to the tomb, and they have a little different approach, don't they? True, John got there first, but he didn't go in. Peter, true to his character, barged right in. But I want you to notice something. Again, the word see, or the word saw. In fact, John uses 3 different Greek words that are all translated see, or some version of to see. In verse 5, he's talking about himself. He got to the tomb and he glanced in. It's a casual glance. He just kind of looked in. That was it. The next verse says Peter went inside and saw the linen lying there. Now that's a different word. That word means to look carefully, to observe. It's the Greek word from which we get the word to theorize. It's to try to make sense of what you're seeing. It's a closer observation. But then we get to verse 8. Finally, John goes inside the tomb, and what does he say? He saw and believed. And that's a third different Greek word, and that word means to perceive with intelligent comprehension. You see, there's a progression here. First, there's a casual glance. Then there's more careful consideration. But finally, it leads to a comprehensive perception. All the pieces came together. It made sense. And not only did John see, but what? He saw and believed. Now, what did he believe? Because verse 9 says they still didn't understand from Scripture that Jesus had to rise from the dead. They didn't have all the answers. They didn't realize how it all fit together. But John took what he had and made a decision. Thomas said, I will not believe until. John said, I don't know all the answers, but I believe. And that is true faith. I'm not talking about some blind leap of faith where you close your eyes, hold your nose, and take a big jump into the unknown. John was there. John saw. But he didn't have all of the facts. Unlike Mary and Thomas at the end, he hadn't seen Jesus. Mary didn't believe Jesus had risen until he saw her, or she saw him. Thomas didn't believe until he saw Jesus. John hadn't seen Jesus yet, but he believed. He chose to believe, even though he may not have felt like it, all of his emotions may not have made sense, even though he didn't have all of the answers, he didn't have all of the facts, he saw enough and he chose to believe. And I think that's terribly significant. Now you'll notice that in these three types of vision, I've used the three elements of personality. You have the mind, the emotions, and the will. And I'm not trying to say one's better than the other. What I'm saying is they all have to work together. If we allow our emotions to take over, we'll become overly sentimental. If we allow our intellect to take over, we'll become overly skeptical. But when we allow our mind and our heart to work together, it's going to take an act of our will. We have to choose to believe. People who are waiting for all the answers, the questions to be answered to believe, will never believe. Because there's always going to be doubts. People who wait until they feel like it will never get there. Because our emotions are so unpredictable and quite honestly pretty inconsistent. It takes a commitment. It takes an act of the will. It's just like getting married. I've heard couples say, we're not going to get married until we can afford it. Good luck. Or how many of you heard someone say, we're not going to have a kid until we can afford him? Yeah. It's never going to happen. Or, I'm not ready to get committed, or I'm not ready to commit to that person because, yeah, I'm not sure that all my feelings are lining up. They never will. I mean, come on, you guys that are married, do you always feel like it? You always feel, you know, there was a song, in fact, it was an old song I played for Tammy on our anniversary. And, it starts out saying, we've been together since way back when. And sometimes I never want to see your face again. Think, now if that isn't a picture of marriage, I don't know what is. Now, that's not how the song ended, by the way. But if you wait for your emotions, you'll never commit. If you wait for everything to line up intellectually, it'll never happen. At some point, you just make a decision. I'm going to do this and I'm going to stick with it. That's what faith is all about. And that's not just true of saving faith. That's true of our faith as we continue to live the Christian life. When we go day by day and we have to face the challenges of life, we got to get to a point of saying, okay, God, I don't see how all of this is going to happen. I don't feel necessarily 100% positive about this, but I know who you are. And I'm going to base my choice not on the circumstances and not on how I feel, but I'm going to base my choice on your character. That is what faith is all about. Charles Stanley puts it well. Trusting God means looking beyond what we can see to what God sees. We don't have to trust the circumstances. We don't have to trust our feelings. You shouldn't. In God we trust. And that's where our faith lies. Peter puts it this way. In 1 Peter 1:8, though you have not seen him, you love him. And even though you do not see him now, you believe in him. That's what true spiritual vision is all about. So my challenge to you this morning is this. How well is your spiritual sight? Do you suffer from blurred vision? Do our emotions keep us from seeing the truth? Do we have belligerent vision? Do we have intellectual hang-ups that we just can't get past before we make that commitment? Or do we have believing vision? Based not on what we know or feel, but based on who we trust. Our invitation hymn this morning is hymn number 213. I just think it's so fitting for this message. We're only going to sing the first verse, but notice how each one of the verses begin with the same three words, I know not. There's a lot of things that we don't know. There's a lot of things about the Christian life. There's a lot of things about our lives that we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen. Look at verse 4. I know not what of good or ill may be reserved for me. We don't know the future. We don't know all of the answers. But the chorus says, I know whom I have believed. The only thing we have to know is the one in whose hands we are. God doesn't give us a roadmap and say, here's what's going to happen the rest of your life. He says, trust me.